You're listening to Office Hours, a series of curious conversations with Belfer Center experts. We sat down with nuclear expert Matthew Bunn, professor of practice at the Harvard Kennedy School, who previously served in the Clinton White House as an advisor on science and technology.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I have no memory of what I wanted to be when I grew up. I was really interested in science when I was in middle school and high school. And I went off to MIT for college with the idea of majoring in physics. So I guess the answer might be that I wanted to be a physicist at some point.
Is that the gateway drug to becoming a nuclear expert? Is chemistry, physics?
Not necessarily. You got to remember, when I was going off to college, it was peak of the Cold War. Everybody was desperately worried about whether the world was actually going to be incinerated in a big nuclear war. I remember, as a sort of political prank, at MIT, they have a central corridor that runs through with a big area in the middle where they have four walls. And one wall has engraved the names of the MIT people who were killed in World War I. One wall has the names of the MIT people who were killed in World War II. One wall has the names of the MIT people who were killed in Korea and Vietnam. And one wall is blank. And so we, as a prank, took all of the pages of the MIT directory and made a huge sign that the size of the blank wall that said, "In memory of those who will die in the next war." So that was sort of
a twisted prank.
That was sort of the atmosphere.
That's right.
People were
genuinely
worried. Yeah. And I took a course with an MIT faculty member about nuclear weapons and arms control. And that was interesting to me. So I got what was supposed to be a summer job with him. Yeah. And that project ended up taking me 3 years. So by that time, I was pretty far along in thinking about these topics.
And this is something that also runs in the family, is that correct?
And so my father was one of the negotiators of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the most important and foundational nuclear treaty there is. All countries on Earth, except for four, are parties to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Actually, there are five at the moment because South Sudan hasn't gotten around to signing up yet. They've had a few other things on their mind. But he had retired from that work when I was 7 years old. And because when Nixon was elected, my father was ambassador to the Geneva Disarmament Conference, and he was a liberal Democrat, and so he was expecting to get the boot. And so he resigned, and we moved out to Wisconsin, where I mostly grew up. So he'd been out of the business for quite some time when I got into the business. But then the freeze movement happened, and it turned out that he was the only person in Wisconsin who'd ever actually negotiated with a Russian about nuclear arms. And so he started getting invited to give talks all the time. And he said, that actually was the most interesting and exciting part of my career. I should go back and do that again. And so he got back into the business after I was already in the business. And so then we were sort of professional colleagues for many years.
He followed you.
In a sense.
That way.
In a sense. We only once actually co-authored an article together. But when I was editor of Arms Control Today, I did edit several articles of his. I remember one hilarious situation where it was right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was an interesting legal question. My father was a lawyer, as to what treaties are the new states that came out of the Soviet Union sort of automatically party to, because they're parts of what the Soviet, it's the concept in legal terms referred to as state succession. And so he and a lawyer colleague of his named John Rhinelander had written an article on this topic. And there was a sentence in this article, I could not figure out what the heck it said. I read it several times. It was just not clear what it said. So I called him up. I said, "Dad, what the heck are you trying to say here?" And he said, "Well, we couldn't agree." And so we intentionally wrote it in an ambiguous way. And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm not putting in my magazine a sentence that even the author doesn't know what it says. You figure it out, or I'm taking the sentence out."
That created a little bit of tension at Thanksgiving, or were you guys able to patch that one up? How do you make a nuclear bomb? Is there a recipe of some sort? It's a dash of plutonium, a little pixie dust. What's this? What's the secret ingredient here?
Well, unfortunately, it's not much of a secret. You need nuclear material that's difficult to make. In a way, Mother Nature has been both kind to us and cruel to us in the way that the laws of nature are set up. Kind in that the material you need to make a nuclear bomb doesn't occur in nature and is pretty difficult to make. So if the material you needed for a nuclear bomb was, you know, lying around on the ground and could be mined out of a mine or whatever, our species might well have destroyed itself, you know, long ago. You need either highly enriched uranium, which is very concentrated in the kind of uranium known as uranium-235, right, which is less than 1% of the uranium you dig up out of the ground. The uranium you dig up out of the ground is more than 99% uranium-238, which is very difficult to split and useless for nuclear bombs.
What ground? Making. I mean, is this in our backyard we might find some uranium? Or are there?
Uranium is widely distributed around the world. During World War II, the United States thought there was only a smidgen of uranium in the world and only a few places, right, and we were working on trying to lock down all those places. Turns out that's not true. There's uranium all over the place. It's about as common, and a little bit more common than tin in the Earth's crust.
So you enrich the uranium.
So you need either enriched uranium, or the other thing you can do is use plutonium. If you take that natural uranium that's mostly U-238, and put it in a reactor where there are neutrons flying around, that U-238 will absorb a neutron, and then it's not very stable in that form, so it decays and it decays and then it turns into plutonium-239. So that plutonium-239 is also usable in bombs. So you have a lump of either uranium-235 or plutonium-239 is what you need for a nuclear bomb. The lump is not necessarily very big, so a grapefruit of plutonium is enough.
Is enough for what?
For a nuclear bomb. So the bomb that obliterated the Japanese city of Nagasaki had more or less a grapefruit-sized ball
of plutonium. You could just tear it around.
No. You need to figure out how to cause the reaction to take place. So there are essentially the problem of making a nuclear bomb, once you have the material, is figuring out how to get enough of the material together before it starts blowing itself apart so that a big amount of the reaction will take place. Because what happens when you get a bunch of this material together is the reaction starts happening, and then it heats up that metal chunk of material, and that starts to expand, and then the atoms are far enough apart that the neutrons don't hit the atoms anymore. They go flying off into the surrounding countryside, and the reaction stops. So you got to figure out, how do I get it together fast enough that a whole bunch of it is together in one place, and I can get a whole bunch of that reaction to take place?
Sure.
So there are two ways people have thought of to do that. Mm. One is, you take two pieces of this material, slam them together at high speed.
Right.
That's what's called a gun-type bomb. It's literally like a gun. The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was a cannon that fired one chunk of highly enriched uranium into another chunk of highly enriched uranium. All there was to it, basically. But you can't really do that with plutonium, because plutonium has a lot of extra neutrons flying around all the time. If you're moving the two pieces together in a gun, when they're about here, the reaction will start going and it'll blow itself apart before you get very much out of it. With plutonium, you need to make what's called an implosion bomb, where you have a ball, you wrap explosives around it, and you design the explosives in a very careful way such that they crush the ball to a higher density, and that sets off the reaction. That means the atoms are closer together so that when one of them splits and releases some neutrons, they're definitely going to hit another atom, and then the whole chain reaction starts going.
With nuclear bombs, because they can be very unstable, are they more like wine or like sushi? Do they mature with age, or do you need them to be fresh? Is that why we got to keep on updating them? Are we worried about nuclear fission sort of happening?
No, nuclear weapons last for a long, long time.
How long would they last?
Well, there's some debate. So The latest thinking is that the plutonium components of U.S. nuclear weapons are probably good for a century or so before they need to be remanufactured. But the material in them lasts essentially forever. The half-life of plutonium, that means the time for half of the atoms to decay to something else, is 24,000 years. The half-life for uranium-235 is 750 million years. And by the way, after the 24,000 years, what the plutonium-239 decays to is uranium-235.
Which is, anyway, stuff, nuclear material.
Which should last for 750 million. Right. So basically, the stuff doesn't go away.
So then why do we have 7,000 nukes? Or what's the difference between having 5 nukes and having 5,000? Is there a difference?
Well, of course there's a difference. You can destroy a lot more stuff if you have thousands than if you have 5. If you have 5, you have to be very careful, you know, what particular places you want to point them at.
Do we need to build more than them? I mean, if we have 7,000, there aren't 7,000 cities in the world that we'd want to blow up. Why does it matter how many we have beyond a certain number?
So my own view is we need many fewer than we have. But the argument for having thousands is that you want to be targeting not cities, but military targets. And there's lots of military targets, and they're fairly dispersed, and you might need, you know, a couple of nuclear weapons for each one. And further, there is an argument in terms of reassuring U.S. allies that the United States nuclear umbrella will protect them, that it might conceivably, at least from a political point of view, matter whether you have at least roughly as many as the next other country has. So there's been a doctrine in the United States of our nuclear force being second to none. I personally don't think that matters. I think, you know, if we had enough nuclear weapons for our deterrent, somebody else had 5 times that many nuclear weapons, I wouldn't care very much. Why do you need enough, as Khrushchev put it, to make the rubble bounce?
So what's the closest we've ever gotten to nuclear war?
Well, of course, that's hard to say. A lot of people say the Cuban Missile Crisis. Many of the participants in that crisis think it was, you know, a 25% shot or 30% shot that it might have led to nuclear war. There were particular nights in that crisis where some of the members of the executive committee really worried that they might never see the dawn, and their families might never see the dawn. In the 1961 Berlin crisis, I have a colleague who's getting on in years now, who at that time was a captain in command of a unit of nuclear artillery, and his orders were, if Soviet tanks come through that point right over there, you're to fire nuclear weapons on your own authority.
Wow.
At the level of a captain. Imagine.
Seems 20s almost.
There's
a
remarkable in some ways that we ever survived. But, you know, today we have India and Pakistan, who, unlike the United States and the Soviet Union, share a border,
right?
A border that's disputed. They've fought 4 wars so far. Pakistan has the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world, coupled with some of the most capable terrorists in the world, who have repeatedly attacked some of the most heavily guarded facilities in Pakistan, including Pakistani Army headquarters, and who have carried out terrorist attacks in India, that India now says that if that happens again, it's going to attack Pakistan with conventional forces. Pakistan says, well, our new doctrine is we're going to have short-range tactical nuclear weapons that we're going to use early against those invading Indian forces if India tries to invade us. So you could easily imagine that if each side's doctrines play out as they're supposed to, that it could lead to nuclear war. And the latest climate science suggests that even a limited Indian-Pakistani war could, if it involved attacking cities, the burning of cities could put so much smoke up into the upper atmosphere, which would then disperse over the whole northern hemisphere, as to disrupt agriculture over all of the northern hemisphere for a couple of years and provoke massive global famines, what some people call nuclear fall, as opposed to nuclear winter that we worried about with respect to a massive U.S.-Soviet nuclear exchange.
Is that the area, is India-Pakistan the area that you worry about most from a nuclear perspective?
Well, in terms of the likely use of nuclear weapons in anger, yes, I think that's by far the most likely place right now. The other thing I worry about is terrorists using nuclear weapons. I've spent a lot of my career over the last quarter century or so trying to make sure that the nuclear material you could use to make a nuclear bomb is secure and accounted for so that it can't fall into terrorist hands. Because unfortunately, it's not as hard to make a bomb once you have the nuclear material as we would wish. Repeated studies by the government in the United States, by governments in several other countries, have concluded if a fairly sophisticated terrorist group got hold of nuclear material, it is at least plausible that they could make a crude, unsafe, unsophisticated nuclear bomb.
That's something I haven't quite understood, because in the 1940s, it took the United States 100,000 people, 5 years, something like 5% or 10% of the electricity of the United States to build the first bomb. So it's not that these terrorist groups will be able to enrich their uranium or reprocess their plutonium.
Yeah.
It's more that somebody will give them, or they will break in and get some nuclear material and then make the bomb
themselves. Or they might buy it on a nuclear black market, because there have been about 20 cases of seizure of stolen highly enriched uranium or plutonium that are reasonably well documented in the public literature. There's a couple of others that are...
20 cases?
Yeah, more or less. But one thing to remember about the Manhattan Project, much more than 90% of the work was making the nuclear material.
Yeah.
Once you have the nuclear material, unfortunately, it's not as hard as you might think. So with highly enriched uranium, it's literally a matter of slamming two pieces together at high speed. With plutonium, it's more complicated, but again, it doesn't have to be as complex as the Nagasaki bomb was, and again, repeated government studies have said this is something we need to worry about. The United States spends more than $1 billion every year protecting its own nuclear weapons and nuclear materials, including the plutonium. If we didn't think the plutonium was an issue, we could save a lot of money on that we're spending on those security measures.
Getting back to this idea of nuclear security, I mean, you said the Nagasaki bomb was the size of a grapefruit.
No, the bomb was not the size of a grapefruit. The bomb was an enormous device.
The nuclear material.
The nuclear material was small.
Somebody could transport that out pretty easily, or do they need like suits and stuff? Do they need to put it in a briefcase? Can you just
so there's a picture I often use, which is of a guy in a t-shirt and remarkably dirty chinos, holding a box in one hand, and that box has the plutonium for the first ever nuclear bomb for the Trinity test. He's got no special equipment. He's got no special nothing. And for highly enriched uranium, it's even worse. It's not very radioactive. In the early days of the Chinese nuclear weapons program, they used to manufacture the highly enriched uranium components by hand with no special protective equipment. Unfortunately, this stuff doesn't, if you want to manufacture plutonium, plutonium is very bad if you breathe it. And so you want to do it within a glove box and so on. But, people making heroin out of opium poppies are using glove boxes too to protect themselves from the.
So you can just take it through an airport or something. I mean,
These days, most airports, most official border crossings, have some kind of radiation detector in place. The United States has spent a lot of money on that. Those will do a decent job at detecting radiological material for a dirty bomb. That's putting out a lot of gamma rays.
What's a dirty bomb?
So a dirty bomb is just something that will spread radioactive material over an area.
It's cruder.
It doesn't incinerate the heart of a major city the way a real nuclear bomb does. It just makes an expensive and nasty mess. It would create a lot of panic. Probably wouldn't kill anybody. But you'd have to, it could cause billions of dollars in disruption and cleanup costs. Anyway, you can detect the material for that kind of thing, or most of the material that you'd use for that kind of thing, reasonably easy. Plutonium, you can probably detect. Highly enriched uranium, if it's decently shielded, is very difficult to detect.
Wow.
Now, if you're looking for... There are ways that you can potentially do it, but a lot of the detectors that we have in place around the world today, if it was shielded, wouldn't necessarily notice highly enriched uranium. There has been at least one case of a detector allegedly, one of these 20 cases I mentioned of seizure of stolen highly enriched uranium and plutonium did involve a radiation detector at a border picking up some highly enriched uranium. I personally would not put too much reliance on radiation detectors at borders. One of the things that you find when you look at the real cases where stolen material that already was stolen has been seized is a lot of it had to do with good police and intelligence work.
Right.
It was stings, or it was somebody who knew about the conspiracy dropping a dime, calling the police and telling them about it. And so making sure that each of the relevant countries has a unit of their national intelligence or national police that's trained and equipped and focused to deal with these cases is quite important. But the reality is, the real leverage we have is getting good security at the place where the stuff is supposed to be in the first place. Once it's gone out the door, it could be anywhere, and all of the other layers of defense are variations on looking for needles in haystacks. We can get better at finding the needles in the haystacks, but it's better to, you know, keep it in the needle pack in the first place.
What's the funniest attempt you've heard of to steal or bribe to get nuclear material?
Oh, well, you know, there are lots of incompetent people in this world. There was one guy who had not nuclear bomb material, but radiological material, potential dirty bomb material, and he was carrying it around in his breast pocket and gave himself a lethal dose of radiation right to the heart.
This is like a Darwin Award.
Exactly. The Japanese terror cult, Shinrikyo, we were the people who made nerve gas and launched a nerve gas attack in the Tokyo subways. They went over to Russia and attempted to set up a meeting with the Minister of Atomic Energy to just offer him $1 million for a nuclear bomb. Now, there are charges that particular minister might have been corrupt, but he wasn't.
Yeah.
That's not going to work, just, you know, waving a check around when you're... but, you know, there are more sophisticated. So a decade or so ago, there was a Russian court case that revealed that a Russian businessman was offering $750,000, which at that time was about a century of the average worker's salary, for stolen weapon-grade plutonium for sale to a foreign client, and was sensible enough to go to one of the what are called the nuclear cities in Russia, cities that were set up solely for the purpose of producing nuclear weapons and their essential ingredients. He made contact with a couple of people in the city who said, yeah, we'll steal plutonium for you. And he gave them $50,000 in upfront money with the promise of the rest to come on delivery of the stuff. And fortunately for the world, the people he was talking to were scam artists, and they came back later with a canister of stuff that wasn't plutonium. But, you know, the fact that somebody was offering $750,000 for stolen weapon-grade plutonium is worrisome.
Scary. It seems like one rogue scientist could just bring this whole system down or share nuclear secrets with the world. Has that happened? Has there been somebody who has...
Well, so...
spread the knowledge.
One of the key leaders of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, Abdul Qadir Khan, put together a very effective procurement network to supply Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. And then he had a brilliant idea. Let's take that network and turn it into an export network.
Oh,
now, that was not solely his idea. Some of the transfers appear to have been, although the Pakistani government denies it, authorized by the Pakistani government as opposed to just AQ Khan and his buddies. But he had this network operating with individuals in some 20 countries for more than 20 years before it was finally brought down. And they were supplying, you know, the favorite technology of the determined nuclear cheater, the uranium enrichment centrifuge, as well as in some cases actual nuclear bomb designs to Iran, Libya, North Korea.
Right.
They attempted to supply to Iraq But Iraq didn't have a chance to take them up on it before the first Gulf War intervened. And then one scary thing is, in some of the seized documents from within this network, all of the countries that we know about that they supplied to are mentioned by name. You know, here's the package for Libya, right. Here's the package for Iran, etc. And then there's all these references to the fourth customer. So somebody that even the network considered so sensitive, they didn't want to put down the name in the documents. And we've never managed to determine who was the fourth customer.
And AQ Khan, he must have been paid handsomely for this?
Indeed.
And so what
tens to hundreds of millions of dollars.
Wow. And where is he now?
He was under house arrest for a while, but he's a hero in Pakistan for having helped to provide Pakistan with nuclear weapons.
He's running free right now.
And he's a free man.
The
in
man
Pakistan.
who shared nuclear Almost secrets with North Korea, Libya, and Iran.
Most of the members of the network did spend some time in jail, but pretty much all of them who are still alive are free men today and rich men today.
And is there anything stopping from those people from, say, giving it to a terrorist organization?
No.
Is there a punishment?
A terrorist organization wouldn't necessarily prefer the kinds of designs that they had available, because the kinds of designs they had available were designs that a state had developed that, you know, are hard to manufacture.
They wouldn't be able to give nuclear material, say. They'd be able to give you designs of how to enrich and reprocess plutonium.
Right. But, and I'm saying the weapon design, if I were Al-Qaeda or ISIS, I would love to have that weapon design. There's no doubt. But I might not do it exactly that way. I might try to do something simpler and easier.
Are there laws? Are there some?
Al-Qaeda, by the way, had a substantial nuclear weapons program that reported directly to Zawahiri.
Oh.
The nuclear CEO of Al-Qaeda is still at large. We think he's probably in Iran, but we don't know for sure. They progressed as far as carrying out some conventional explosives tests in the desert in Afghanistan that were quite crude, but were on the right track. They were more or less, if I had been, you know, advising for their level of resources and sophistication, it's more or less what I would have suggested. Today, I worry about the Islamic State. Al-Qaeda itself, obviously, the core Al-Qaeda that was running that nuclear program is very much reduced in its capabilities. But the Islamic State today is focused on building its caliphate, not on doing huge attacks in Europe or the United States. But they have a vision of a final war between the Crusader forces and the Muslim community, as they see it. And their vision is they're going to win that war. And so they're going to need, presumably, some powerful weapons in order to do that. If they ever did turn to trying to get nuclear weapons, they have more money, more people, more control of territory, more ability to recruit experts globally than Al-Qaeda at its strongest ever had. So to me, it makes it all the more important to make sure that the essential ingredients of those recipes that they might be able to get from, you know, remnants of the AQ Khan network or others are, make sure the essential ingredients are secure, accounted for, so they can't get what they would need to make a nuclear bomb. So.
Sometimes you feel that with these negotiations that go on, it feels like, to an outsider, like in a James Bond movie. People are flying to Vienna, there's secret negotiations.
It is the furthest possible thing from a James Bond movie.
Why? Why is that?
The negotiations are a bunch of, you know, middle-aged guys and women sitting around a table. If it's U.S.-Russian, it's like, you know, there's bottles of mineral water on the table and a U.S. flag and a Russian flag, you know, pushing pieces of paper back and forth and so on. There are some more exciting things that do go on in terms of the removals of nuclear material from various places. So in 1994, for example, on Project Sapphire, the United States found out, mainly because of one particular guy at the U.S. Embassy in Kazakhstan, that there was a place in Kazakhstan where there was hundreds of kilograms of highly enriched uranium, pretty close to weapon grade, with completely terrible security. And we hatched a scheme to just airlift it out of there. You know, the U.S. people flew in under complete secrecy with all of this, you know, high-tech stuff to package the material and so on. There were all sorts of problems in the packaging of the material because the facility was not, you know, well set up, blah, blah, blah. And then by the time we got the packaging done, it was getting to be winter. And the, you know, there was ice on the runway. We had, you know, a huge U.S. aircraft. They actually had a sort of machine with a jet engine pointed down onto the runway to, and the thing was on wheels, to sort of essentially melt the ice in front of the plane as it was, you know, caroming down the runway to get the plane out of Kazakhstan and fly that stuff to Tennessee.
Sounds pretty exciting.
I have a colleague who, when she was 7 months pregnant with her first child, against the direct orders of both her boss and her boss's boss, flew to Kazakhstan to finish a deal about getting rid of another stock of HEU in Kazakhstan. And then, when that child was about 7 months old, she spent both Thanksgiving and Christmas in Libya getting rid of the last HEU in Libya. And aren't we glad that she did that before the fighting broke out in Libya. And aren't we glad that we got the highly enriched uranium out of Ukraine before the, because there were several bombs worth of highly enriched uranium in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we got all of that out only in 2012.
Wow.
So just before the fighting started.
One last question.
Okay.
Where are nuclear negotiations today? Does it make you optimistic about the future? Or are you worried?
It's not that there's no progress in reducing the nuclear threat. There is progress in several aspects of reducing the nuclear threat, but it is a dangerous time. I was debating with a colleague in Moscow, a U.S. colleague, whether U.S.-Russian relations were worse and more dangerous than at any time since Andropov was leader of the Soviet Union in 1983 and really thought the United States was planning a nuclear first strike at any moment, or whether they were worse than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was where the debate was.
Yikes. Professor Bunn, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.